Hello, this is Coach Kiyomi, and welcome to another episode of Invisible Power, Achieving Greatness from the Inside Out. And today's special guest is Amy Colvin. She is a compassion expert and meditation instructor. She is also the author of Cultivating Compassion, Simple Everyday Practices for Discovering Peace of Mind and Resilience. Welcome, Amy. It's so great to have you here today.
Thanks, Kiyomi. I appreciate being here, and it's going to be fun talking with you for a while.
Absolutely. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into compassion.
Well, I started out with a compassion-based meditation path about 25 years ago. It's a blend of Taoism and Buddhism. So that's the way back story. But I really got interested in the idea of sharing compassion and teaching compassion a little bit more because my primary job right now is as a massage therapist, and I see all kinds of people that come in with physical distress as well as emotional and mental distress. And I began thinking, you know, I would really like to help these people have some tools to help themselves, because so often stress, whether it's emotional or mental, or even just the physical stress of being uncomfortable in our bodies, so much of that can be helped by taking care of ourselves and in a meditative way, by having some mindful awareness, whether it's mindful awareness about what our brain is doing at any given moment, whether it's mindful awareness about what our bodies are doing at any given moment. So from my work as a massage therapist, I thought, yeah, I'd really like to begin focusing on helping people have some tools to help themselves. And I really like the idea of compassion. I know that mindfulness meditation has been out there for a long, long time. And, you know, hats off to Jon Kabat-Zinn and the whole group of people that ended up getting mindfulness-based stress reduction out there and doing the research around that. And then just a few years ago, I found that there was actually a few places that were beginning to focus on compassion meditation, which really pulled my heartstrings. So that's how I got into it.
Great. And you did a training at Stanford, and I've read Kelly McGonigal's book. It's amazing, The Science of Compassion. So you participated in that training, and tell us a little bit about the training.
Yeah, I did. And actually, as I was looking at finding ways to start teaching compassion meditation, I did find out that Stanford actually has an 8-week program called Compassion Cultivation Training. And Kelly McGonigal is one of the senior teachers of that program. And so a few years ago, I applied and got in and went through their teacher training certification. And I'm now certified to teach that particular program. Met some fabulous people there. And what I really liked about what I learned in that program, above and beyond what I had spent 20-something years doing with my own meditation teachers, is the idea of really adding some structure to how to facilitate classes and how to facilitate ideas. The other thing that was tremendously valuable in attending the program. And the program is through it's an acronym called CCARE, and it's part of the Stanford School of Medicine. So anybody can go look, do a Google search for CCARE and Stanford, and they'll find a whole host of information about that program. But what I liked about it, not only was the structure, but that blend between current research, modern psychology, along with ancient wisdom traditions, primarily Buddhism in their case, and my background is primarily Taoist. So what I liked was learning about how to incorporate some ideas from current psychology with that spiritual side. For example, one of the topics that I cover in my courses that I learned about in the Stanford program is the idea put forth by Marshall Rosenberg that says unskillful behavior comes from unmet needs. So if I were to ask you, just without giving any further explanation, what does that mean to you when I say unskillful behavior comes from unmet needs?
I would interpret it as that if we don't have specific needs met, then we may go about trying to get those needs met in unskillful, maladaptive ways that aren't necessarily the most effective or productive. Yeah.
Exactly. And so when you think about either times in your life where others or yourself have behaved in just really horrific ways, like you get in a fight with your best friend and you can't figure out why in the world your best friend just unloaded on you, one tool that you can use is to think to yourself, hey, this isn't usually the way she responds to me. I wonder what's going on. And then from that place of open-heartedness and open-mindedness and compassion, you could say to your friend, hey, what's going on for you? How are you doing today? Instead of getting defensive and reactive. Mm-hmm. So, and then it probably would turn out that your best friend is actually just having a bad day for some reason. And the fact that you've created space through being open-hearted, open-minded, and compassionate, that can then in turn help her move out of that unskillfully behaving place, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is that one of the valuable takeaways, Marshall Rosenberg, by the way, I think people may not know who he is, and he's a communication expert in nonviolent communication, right? And he is an amazing person, or was an amazing person. I know he passed away recently, I believe, and did a tremendous amount of training in conflict resolution, kind of communication, and compassion as a foundation. And so being able to approach situations, people, when their unskillful behavior can be, they're acting out. We find them annoyed, irritated, right? We're saying they're being ornery to us. And if we can step back and ask that question to ourselves, or have that thought in mind, what, there may be an unmet need right now. There's a mindset of curiosity, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's openness rather than closed off. So that sounds like a really valuable aspect to the compassion training.
Yes, and that's exactly it. So, and the other nice thing about looking at it that way is being able to blend that sense of spirituality in whatever way that means for you. It could be Christianity. It could be something that's undefined, as I know there's something greater than me out there and I have faith in that, but I don't have a name for it. Whatever it is, being able to blend that sense of spirituality with that modern psychology is really powerful. Mm. And being able to just sort of grow in both directions at the same time. For example, I was teaching a class just the other evening, and one of the gals in class was talking about, well, how in the world do you, you know, how in the world do you be open-hearted in some of these situations? And I'm trying to, you know, bolster my spiritual practice through meditation, but I'm just not quite getting it. And then that's where that power of the benefit of psychology comes in as well. It's like, hey, well, think of it this way. And so it was really great to have a conversation around meditation growth, mindfulness, awareness, spiritual path, but then also be able to say that there are these valuable tools that come out of psychology, just like the one we discussed.
Right, absolutely. And I'm curious, when it comes to spirituality, because there's a lot of different definitions, and whether it's just feeling a higher sense of purpose and meaning, I've heard that as a helpful definition for people who don't believe necessarily in a higher power, that spiritual can just be a feeling of purpose greater than oneself. And then there's a whole spectrum. Did they address that in the program? And
to a degree, actually, one of the other really nice things, depending on who you are, about the compassion cultivation training is that it was is designed to be completely secular. So there really wasn't any particular mention about spirituality, and so one can practice mindfulness, meditation, without necessarily having a connection to that higher sense of purpose. And that's one of the areas where I've diverged a little bit, because for me, I think it's really valuable. And I think that it's wonderful that there's programs out there that are completely secular. But I like the idea of being able to tie people back to the idea that there is a higher purpose, or that there is something greater than ourselves. Another way that I like to think about it that may be accessible or may resonate with people who don't have a particular spiritual path is the idea that when I think of a higher power, I think of that internal wisdom, that thing that makes us unique. And so if you think about it from that place of, you know, what is it? What is that spark that's in me that makes me me? Mm-hmm. That might be another way of looking at, you know, it's just all language for me, at least, around the idea of connecting with our inner wisdom, that divine within, or that individual spark that makes me me, and that spark that makes you you.
Oh, wonderful. Yes, being able, because that's a part of compassion, is there can be a dehumanization when we're feeling frustrated, irritated. We don't see the humanity in another. And so a big part of compassion training is what mindset, what thoughts can we, or even beliefs, can we tap into that in that moment of irritation, frustration, hostility on our part, how can we connect and see the humanity in another? And so I'm hearing that. And I'm curious, regarding some of the other takeaways for our audience regarding your program or the Stanford training that you've woven into your program, what are some of the other valuable essence?
Well, one of the things that I really liked was how they actually defined compassion. And even though my Taoist training is well-grounded in compassion, I mean, the three pillars of Taoism are moderation, humility, and compassion, there was never really any discussion around, well, what does compassion mean? How is that defined? And through the Stanford program, they put together a definition that I really liked, and it's a threefold definition, where the first part is having an awareness of either your own or someone else's distress or suffering. So that first component is mindfulness or awareness. Mm-hmm. The second component is being emotionally moved by that awareness. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, And not sometimes, but that's where empathy kicks in. Mm. I see you're in distress. My heart goes out to you. Or, you know, I see you're in distress and now I am feeling it. Mm. And then the third step of compassion, based on the definition that I learned through the Stanford program, is then to take action. Mm. And what that means is it could be action along a continuum. It could be as simple as wishing you well. Mm-hmm. You know, we're in different spaces. We're talking over the internet. I recognize that something has happened for you. And it could be as simple as from me far away with intention and attention thinking, you know what, Kiyomi, I really wish you well in this moment. I hope that you have peace for the rest of your day. Or it could be something very tangible and very practical, such as giving your coat off your back to someone who's in need, or serving at the food line at the shelter, or giving money to some organization, or serving voluntary service abroad. Mm-hmm. So compassionate action can take many, many forms, mm-hmm. but it's that essence of taking action that actually moves us into compassion.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah. Let's break each of those down, those three points. So start again with the first one. And we also, if we can weave in how these aspects, self-awareness is so critical, and the mindfulness practice and being able to be aware of what's going on in our body first. Because if we're not aware of our own reactivity, then there's no way we can even do step two or three, right? Move into an empathetic place or then take any kind of action. And so when it comes to self-awareness, what are some techniques that you use to help people become more self-aware?
You know, one of the first ones that I like to use is just helping people begin to draw their awareness to their breath. It's something that we do all the time. It's something we do automatically, and it's what keeps us alive. But because it happens so automatically, so often we don't pay attention to it. And it's really interesting sometimes what comes up if you actually pay attention to the breath. And I remember years ago when I was in massage school, there was a weekend seminar on shiatsu. And I remember the shiatsu instructor saying to me, "You breathe enough to keep you alive, but not enough to do you any good." And I thought, well, what in the world does that mean? You know, and at the time I really didn't completely understand it, but it was a little, you know, it planted the seed of, okay, I should pay attention to this. And ultimately over time, as I cultivated my meditation practice, I began to understand more and more of what that means. And really, for me, bringing awareness to the breath helps create awareness in the body through the fact, for example, if we just right now kind of breathe in through the nose and imagine that breath entering in through our lungs, and we can feel our rib cage expanding, but then take that a little further, and as we inhale, we're beginning to allow our stomach to loosen and create some space. And then as we exhale, that diaphragm moves and it begins to push that air back up through our lungs and then back out. And you can really begin, if you pay attention to it, feel that flow of the breath coming in through the nose, down through the lungs, all the way into the belly. And just that simple act of following that breath and following its impact on the body brings us into body awareness.
That's wonderful. Breath is a very powerful body sensations, right? And breath is one of the first elements that can be so useful, because when we're aware of our breathing, oftentimes that is a measure of our emotional state. If we're holding our breath, if we're breathing faster, slower, the pace, all of those factors. And in that conscious moment, then being able to adjust our breathing pattern, and then tune into how we're feeling, perhaps, our emotional state, and going, what's going on there? And that level of awareness can continue to grow.
And what's fascinating about that, be it what you just said about tuning into our emotional states, is it takes practice. So no matter what, everything we're talking about takes practice. And real quickly, going back to another component that I learned from the Stanford program, is really believing in and having the research support the idea that compassion is trainable. Mm-hmm. So if you start out today and you don't necessarily feel like you feel compassion for yourself, for loved ones, for people you don't know, for people you find to be difficult, take heart. Because it is trainable. Mm-hmm. And it's trainable through practice. And, you know, we don't need to go down that whole, that's a whole conversation in itself. But bringing awareness to our emotions and how those emotions manifest in our body, that also takes practice. But what is brilliant when you do begin to practice with that is you begin to have a better understanding and a better awareness of how different emotions, different strong emotions feel in the body. So for example, I've gotten to the point where I can recognize in my body what anger feels like, what fear feels like, what sadness feels like. And that becomes a really useful tool when difficult challenges arise. For example, at the beginning of the year, something came up for me and my initial response to it was anger and fear. And that was an intellectual response as well as a visceral response. So I started kind of dissecting it intellectually and figuring out, you know, where I'd gone awry and where I thought the other person had gone awry and so on and so forth. But I wasn't really coming up to any place of heartfelt closure. And I slept on it. And the next morning I got up and I said to my husband, I said, you know, what I realize is that I'm just really sad. Mm. I felt so completely misinterpreted. Mm-hmm. That's the overriding emotion. And once I was able to identify that as sadness, it totally changed how I intellectually wanted to process that information. Mm. I no longer was angry. I was no longer fearful, but I could then work with that sadness, and that helped me move through that much more quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that level of awareness is extremely powerful, because when we're aware, then we can actually have a choice rather than letting it control us, our emotions, our thoughts, feeling a victim to circumstances. We can then say, what do I have control over? And then move from there. So really, really good stuff. And when it comes to the second aspect that you had mentioned, you repeat that, and we'll go into that a little bit. I know we've got a lot of different topics we can cover too, but let's just review these other last two again.
Yeah. So again, that first one was awareness. And the second one then is being emotionally moved by that distress that you see in someone else or in yourself.
Okay. And when it comes to resilience and being able to have us weather the storms and challenges and being emotionally moved by others, some people say, well, why does that matter? You know, what difference does that make? How does that help me? Let's just play the devil's advocate and share with me a little bit of being moved by others. Why should people care?
Well, it can actually, that can tie right back to that first instance we were talking about, where, you know, your girlfriend has behaved very badly, unskillfully towards you. You could choose to completely disregard that and, you know, be hard-hearted. And I mean, you know this person, you love this person. She's been your friend for a long, long time. You could harden your heart to the idea that she's behaving in a rude fashion towards you. And when you behave hard-heartedly, you are not only not providing any support for her, you're also shutting down your own openness, your own open-heartedness, your own compassion. And so then the benefit of being emotionally moved is that you actually are coming from that higher place. You're coming from that divine wisdom. You're coming from that unique spark that's, you know, makes you you. And you are being of service to your friend by slowing down and saying, hey, what's going on with you? And that's where, and not, so by being emotionally moved, not only are you offering support and compassion and love and kindness to your friend, you are benefiting from that open-heartedness.
Yes. Yeah. And thank you, because there's several important pieces there. One is us remembering we're interconnected, right? So a lot of people, we're in a me-oriented culture, and how to think of we. So when we're moved by others, we are being of service, and there's that servant leadership. How can we support others' well-being, happiness, success? And when we connect to that, that calms ourselves down, right? From our own inner dialogue, being right, fear, anxiety, all those things. And then being able to, the movement of I care about that person. And when we open ourselves up, it supports our own health and well-being, rather than putting up a wall and shutting down, that there's a whole host of benefits. So it's a really excellent point.
Mm-hmm. And along with all of that is that aspect of vulnerability. So, you know, one of the barriers to compassion is that people don't want to be vulnerable. They don't either want to be vulnerable for themselves, or they don't want to express vulnerability to other people. But in that moment of open-heartedness, there is that vulnerability. And again, the more we connect with that, the richer our own lives become, And as our lives become more rich, then we have that ability to continue extending service out. And as you said, service through leadership and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And by staying open, we're actually, our energy is flowing, if you will, right? We're not blocking it, stuffing, denying. And when we do that, that helps us and gives us more energy. It's amazing. I think for all of us, when we've had a moment of compassion, when we can be moved by another's pain or sadness or suffering, there's something that opens within us and that can give us energy rather than shut down. So in challenging situations, that can make us more resilient, right? Because we're not fighting and resisting the person or the situation. There's a receptivity that then is incredibly moving and empowering for all parties involved.
Yes, and I'm so glad that you brought up that idea of internal energy, because that is a big piece of it. It's just allowing our energy to flow. And part of, for me, especially coming up from a Taoist tradition, meditation does involve connecting with that internal flow of energy, that qi. And it's critical to stay open-hearted and open-flowing and not locked down or dried up and shriveled like a leaf.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. Yes, that's a lot of people's MO, and they're not even aware of it. They don't know how to shift out of it. So wonderful information. And I'm just looking at some of the other questions here. You mentioned a common barrier to compassion. And I can't remember if you can say what you said. And then I think you have a few others, because it can be challenging for many people.
Yeah. So I mentioned the idea that vulnerability can be a barrier to compassion. Again, vulnerability, because it's easier, you know, some people, and I've been there. I mean, one of the great things about being able to teach compassion meditation classes now is that I used to be the person who hid in the closet and beat myself up with an invisible cat of nine tails. I used to experience situational depression on a fairly regular basis. And through the choice, which is a word you brought up earlier, which I love, through choice, I have decided to learn skills and practice skills that help move me into a new and different place. But one thing that happens is when we're afraid of looking at those difficult places within ourselves, we are not open to vulnerability. We are just shut down, because it's like, you know, for example, when you go to the beach and you're going to go snorkeling, and you know that right near the shallows are some really beautiful little fish and you're having fun with those, but you keep swimming a little further and further out, and you know that if you want to see the sea turtles, you have to get a little bit further out into the water. And yet, if you go out around that point where the water gets darker, maybe you're going to see a shark instead of a sea turtle. And so if you allow yourself that to succumb to the fear of the shark, the fear of the unknown, then you'll never open yourself up to some of the beauty that could be in that other place. And that's where I'm thinking about with vulnerability. Part of the process of becoming aware of ourselves and comfortable in our own skin and moving into a place of self-acceptance, mm-hmm. and self-compassion, mm-hmm. requires us to embrace all of who we are. Mm-hmm. And yeah. That can be really scary.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that vulnerability, it's a big topic right now. Brené Brown's done an amazing job with her book, Daring Greatly, and how we can be vulnerable. And I have found that compassion, self-compassion, is one of the keys to success. And Phil Jackson, who's an amazing coach, was a coach of Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant and all-star, amazing, incredible athletes, that he trained them in compassion and himself. Because when we're in the thick of a game, our inner critic can be so strong, and our sense of I'm not good enough, if I make a mistake, if I mess up, I'm going to lose a game and people are going to think I'm a fool or I'm an idiot or all kinds of things. So we get that threat response in our body, and then we may shut down, and that affects our performance. And when we can be compassionate, then that actually liberates us to make mistakes, but then recover very quickly, be back in the game, think clearly. And so, but it is that level of vulnerability where people have a very hard time saying, you know, I do make mistakes sometimes. And so being able to overcome that barrier through practicing self-compassion is so powerful. Yeah. And what are a couple other barriers that you've noticed?
So another one that kind of ties in with that is in our society, at least in the United States, that if I don't set these really high standards, and if I don't push myself to reach those high standards, then I'm going to be a slacker. And therefore, if I extend compassion to myself, I am going to be a slacker, and I'm not going to achieve that high potential. And so, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely, right. Because people think, well, if I give myself permission, right, they think compassion is somehow giving ourselves permission to slack, to be sloppy in our work, to make lots of mistakes. And there is that misunderstanding that compassion doesn't mean you still can strive to be your best, but it means being more forgiving. And that actually goes back to energy, that it gives us more energy, right, in forgiveness, because then we're not beating ourselves down.
Right. And I liked what you were just saying, using athletes as an example. So let's take, for example, you know, Russell Wilson, the quarterback of the Seahawks. And if he throws an interception, he could choose to beat himself up over that and go, oh my gosh, that's not what I meant to do. That's not what I'm trained to do. I made a mistake. And if he stays in that place of fear and anxiety, it just locks him down, shuts out that energetic flow. Whereas if he takes, and it's that whole thing of I've got to push harder. And if he keeps on pushing harder and harder from that place of anxiety and fear and emotional block or energetic blockage, it's quite possible he's going to throw another interception and throw another interception or get sacked all the time. Whereas if he can take that moment in time, he threw a pass, it wasn't perfect, and go, all right, I accept who I am. I'm a human being. I'm not perfect all the time. I have the next minute going forward. I'm going to strive to do better. And from that place, and that place, I mean, I have no idea if this is what goes on in Russell Wilson's head, but from that place where we can all apply that, and it's like, okay, I have just made a mistake. And I can either beat myself up about that for hours or days or weeks or months, or I can simply acknowledge that I, just like everybody else out there, am a human being. Mm-hmm. And as a human being, I make mistakes. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to accept me, and I'm willing to move on. And that's where that self-compassion component comes in. As opposed to, I'm going to hold myself to these standards, and if I don't meet them, I'm a bad person.
Right. Yeah. Because it can be exhausting having these high expectations of perfection. And perfection is the enemy of productivity, of success. And I think we've been brainwashed by whether it's parents, you know, who have good intentions, but have, you know, been upset with kids for not getting straight A's, or you're not doing good enough. And we move into adulthoods, and maybe have a boss that's, you know, hypercritical and micromanaging. And we can internalize that, and then that stress can affect our performance. But with the amazing invisible power of compassion, and forgiveness, we can then soften that intensity, relax that tension, which then opens our mind, our body up to being more creative, to better problem solving, to then being able to perform better at work, on the court, you know, for any endeavor. It's really powerful, extremely powerful.
And I love the words you used just there, softening that tension. That's, I mean, imagine if we all, every day, because we, I mean, every single day, all of us get stressed out about something. Or, you know, anxious about something, or we hold tension in our bodies physically because of something. Imagine if all of us every day had the aspiration to soften that tension. To not always need to be right. Not to give up, you know, if you and I disagree about something, rather than me giving up and roll, you know, being rolled over by your opinions, I can still stand strong in my opinions and go, you know what, we'll just have to agree to disagree. But softening that tension there, that's really powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. Really, really amazing. And what would you say one other barrier would be to compassion?
Another one, I've got a couple more in mind. So one is that I think is interesting is that, again, in this society, some of us have grown up with the belief that I have to take care of other people first. If I take care of my needs first, then I'm being really selfish. And the oxymoron, or the challenge in that is that if we continue to be of service to others nonstop, if I am constantly looking out for others, taking care of others, helping others, eventually I have no energy left to take care of me. And so a part of self-compassion is being willing to know where your boundaries are and being willing to set them and stick with them and give up that belief that a good person is the one that always takes care of others' peoples first. My perspective is that a good person is the one who's comfortable in his or her own skin. And once they're comfortable in their own skin and have set their own boundaries, well thought out with self-compassion, then they can be able to offer support to other people. And they can offer that support indefinitely. So a lot of times, especially people in healthcare, end up having empathy fatigue, or they end up getting burned out. And a lot of times that comes from the fact that they just give and give and give and give, because that's what society has taught us that we ought to do, as opposed to, I have to take some time off for myself. You know, I don't know if you've ever had a loved one or a family member that is providing care to another. I mean, I think we're probably maybe both at that age where our parents are aging, and it's important to offer respite to that family member who is caring for another one. And I've seen so many instances where the healthy older adult who's taking care of the unhealthy older adult doesn't ever create space for anyone else to come in and help. And then the healthy older adult no longer is healthy enough to take care of anybody, themselves or the other. And so it's important to know where those boundaries are. And the idea that taking care of self first, extending compassion to self first, is really critical in being able to sustain compassionate care for other people.
All right. Well, that was really helpful information. And so let's also go over one other barrier to compassion.
Okay. The last one that I'm thinking of, and this goes back to what you were talking about also in the very beginning about common humanity, is the idea that so-and-so over there, a person I find to be challenging or difficult, has behaved so badly, so unskillfully, that they simply don't deserve any compassion. I don't want to give that person compassion. So what do we do, in those instances? And what I would say is recognize that a person's unskillful behavior is not the sum of all of their parts, and come back and recognize that every single one of us as human beings, we all have a mother and a father. We may not know who they are, but all of us have a mother and a father. All of us are a dear friend to someone. All of us have sadnesses and fears and anxieties. And as such, that creates this common thread. So we are all connected just by the virtue of being human. And as such, as we were talking about earlier, that the beauty and that liberation of having self-compassion, and when you extend compassion to another person, then that opens you up and it opens up that energy flow. So even if there's someone that you find to be really difficult and you believe that they've behaved in such a way that there's just no way you can extend compassion to that person, maybe consider what that person might have been like or looked like as a one-year-old or a two-year-old. And recognize that common humanity. It doesn't mean that you have to agree with his or her behavior. Mm-hmm. But being willing to respect and acknowledge the idea that this person is on this planet and also is just like me.
Right, right. That phrase, Kelly McGonigal uses that phrase, right, in her training, that when you see someone, that may they be free from suffering and may they be happy, something like that, and then adding the phrase, just like me, so that we realize we can see ourselves in another. And as soon as we can make that connection, that is an element of bringing in humanity and that interrelatedness. We're not so different, even though one minute we may feel like it, in the split second we can realize we're really not that different, and then build that bridge. Yeah.
You know, and that's actually a really fabulous segue into a topic you and I have talked about in the past, which is the idea of imposter syndrome. And so for those of you listening that may not know what that is, essentially it's the idea that I'm a fraud, or I really don't belong here, and that comes from that place of not recognizing the common humanity. And so, for example, I didn't know about what imposter syndrome was until a couple of years ago. And a friend of mine at a local tech company asked me if I would help her with a project. And she was videotaping an icebreaker for, you know, team meetings or summits, that kind of thing. And it was an exercise called Step into the Circle. And so we were all standing around, and she, as the facilitator, was outside the circle, and she would say, step into the circle if you've lived in three or more states. And people would step in, and step into the circle if you've lived in five or more states, and people would step in. And it's just a way to recognize common humanity. Or, you know, step into the circle if your favorite broccoli, or, you know, if you enjoy eating broccoli, and then step into the circle if you enjoy eating Brussels sprouts. And it's just, you know, it can be really silly little stuff like that, but it's a way of going, oh yeah, just like you and I both like broccoli, right on. Mm-hmm. And then as we were wrapping up the exercise, she asked the group, does anybody have a question that they want to throw out to use? And one of the people said, yeah, I want to ask, who in this circle has experienced imposter syndrome? And everybody stepped into the circle. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing to me, because here I am at a tech company where, from my perspective as a massage therapist, looking at all of these people who are engineers, mm-hmm, and building and developing and designing really cool new tools, mm-hmm, it was an eye-opener to go, wow, these people don't necessarily recognize that they are super incredible brains and people and have skills, because they're so concerned with comparing themselves to their peers, other engineers, that they've lost that awareness of self, that they are perfect just how they are. I mean, without a doubt, every single one of us can grow every single day. Mm-hmm. But another aspect of imposter syndrome is not being comfortable in your own skin, not being self-accepting, not being self-compassionate. Yeah. And at the time, I didn't necessarily feel imposter syndrome because I was, you know, comfortable with where I was in life and what I was doing. And not too long after I finished writing my book, I was having all these aspirational ideas about, well, you know, wouldn't it be great if someday I end up promoting it, you know, on this TV show or that TV show or, you know. And all of a sudden, that imposter syndrome hit me because I was like, oh my gosh, who am I to believe that I might actually be invited onto so-and-so's show? And it was really interesting to take that and recognize that for what it was. And it's like, you know what? Amy, you're just fine. And your book is what it is. And people will either love it or they won't love it. And either way, it's a product of who I am, and it's good enough.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, and being content with that idea that, you know, is it going to be the next New York Times bestseller? Well, it's not yet.
Right.
It might be.
Right.
But I'm content with what is happening. And, it, you know, I can extend the opportunities to, you know, be on a show or do this or that. But I also need to be content with where it is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, well, imposter syndrome. So it seems like the takeaway from that is that, one, being around really bright people and realizing everybody in the room, except for you in that time, but we all feel imposter syndrome at different times, but everyone in the room stepped in that circle. And so, one, it's another wonderful way of seeing our humanity. Right? That we're not alone in feeling not good enough. That someone's going to find out I'm nervous at times, or I'm not great, but I'm good at something. And oftentimes our skills are really excellent, but we don't give ourselves enough credit because of that inner critic. So compassion can help with managing the inner critic, as well as being able to recognize I'm in a room with other people that feel the same way. So there's an opening and receptivity, and even being moved, letting oneself be moved by that.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's so much in what you just said there, that whole idea of the common humanity and the recognition that we're all alike. We all have moments of fear and anxiety, even though we might be at the top of our game, and a willingness to be open to that and be vulnerable to that, like going back to what we had talked about earlier as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And for the final topic here, that you had shared a really interesting story, because I know a lot of people, when it comes to today's world, that dealing with uncertainty and change is very challenging. And we move in a very fast-paced world. So in today's world, it's much more about survival of the most adaptable. How can we be adaptable, and how can we deal with uncertainty? And there are people that want to change careers, that maybe aren't happy with what they're doing, or maybe they want to pursue something that they love. They're content enough, but they see something greater for themselves. But fear stops them. And you have a wonderful story of making changes, pursuing your dreams, and stepping into that uncertainty. And if you'd share that and how self-compassion and your own self-awareness has helped you do that, follow through on that.
Great. There's been at least one time in my life when I've made a pretty big change, and I'm leaning towards another. But the one I'll bring up is I used to work in tourism, and I'd been in that job for a while. I'd mastered what I was supposed to be doing, and ultimately there was no upward mobility unless I moved from, you know, a city that I loved to a city where I didn't want to be. Mm. So I thought, all right, well, let's change careers. And One of the things that was helpful for me at the time was that I still felt like I had a lot of working years ahead of me. But I spent quite a bit of time thinking about, well, what is it that really makes me happy? And I've always really enjoyed touching people, you know, putting my hands on people, shaking hands. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to actually have a career where I get paid to touch people?
Yeah, a therapeutic healing touch. Yes. Yeah, right.
So
yeah.
I went to massage school, mm-hmm. and after graduation, I started a private practice out of my home, and I let go of my tourism job. And that in itself was a pretty big change. And, you know, going from that stable income of a 40-hour-a-week job to the unknown. And a big piece of what helped me in that transition mm-hmm. was just having the faith that if I followed what made me really happy, I would land on my feet. Mm-hmm. And making the choice to not give in to the anxiety. Mm-hmm. And recognize that it would be hard work, recognize that maybe I would have to tighten the belt straps a little bit. But I made that transition and it was fine. And what's really interesting is how that segues into the next piece of this story where I was working from home. My husband, who was working in corporate America at the time, thought, man, it looks like you're having fun working from home. I want to work from home too. But we were living in a city that was relatively expensive. And for me as a fledgling massage therapist, and when he thought about, you know, what can I do that I know that makes me happy? And he'd been doing some construction before. And he's like, you know, I could get back into doing some remodel and some construction. And so we decided that it probably wouldn't be in our best interests to live in the city in which we lived. So we decided to sell absolutely everything. We sold the 3-bedroom house, all the furniture that was in it, all of our stuff, and we got down to a truck and 5 boxes. Mm. And we started over. Uh-huh. And it was really exciting because we were both willing to embrace change, willing to embrace the unknown, and we had faith that somehow we'd land on our feet. Mm. And we made the choice not to be anxious about it. We made the choice to be self-compassionate in that I want to grow as a human being and I'm going to work on that. I want to grow as a human being by doing something I love rather than doing a job that no longer serves me. And so at that time, we ended up buying a fixer-upper of a house up, out in the woods. And at the time, I also thought, okay, my massage career is over. I am now going to learn how to be a construction worker. And because where we were living, the town was too small to support a local massage practice. Mm-hmm. And I was content with making that change. And I think that's the other thing when you decide to make big career change is that willingness to flow and harmonize mm-hmm. with what comes your way. Mm-hmm. Because you don't always have control over what the next step's going to be. But if you're open-minded and open-hearted mm-hmm. and willing to harmonize and flow, then you can be adaptable. Right. So little did I know, 4 months, was it 4 months? Yeah, 4 months after we bought that house, I got a cold call from an organization who said, would you like to be a massage therapist for us? Mm-hmm. And it was an organization where, as a massage therapist, it was the best working opportunity I ever could have imagined in my life. Mm-hmm. And I love that story just in the fact that I really believe that it's true probably for anyone. If you follow your heart mm-hmm. and you're willing to give up your expectations, but be open to new ideas and new experiences, and you're willing to be self-accepting and self-compassionate, that ultimately the next door is going to open up for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Amazing story of being able to acknowledge what it is you want, the challenges, being able to give up and say, you know, I trust that things will work out. And that really underneath that, you are able to manage any anxiety, because there can be all the fear, the uncertainty, the unknown that prevents people from taking action, from taking big steps like selling one's home and saying, I'm moving to a small town where I may not do what I thought I wanted to do, but I'm open to that. And then the amazing phone call of being able to then randomly, but not so random, maybe more of a coincidence or synchronicity, that you got that call about the massage opportunity. And so, wonderful story. Really powerful, and I think very encouraging for people that are interested in taking a leap of faith, and how compassion can be a powerful tool and applied in many, many areas in our interpersonal relationships, in making change in our life, in many aspects. Wonderful. Well, thank you. And yeah, would you, it would be a wonderful opportunity now for to share a little bit more about how people can find you and workshops and classes that you offer.
Yeah. So you can find everything you need to know at compassionatebalance.com. And the book that I just mentioned that I published, this is a book I launched in September called Cultivating Compassion. And it's set up to be sort of like a workbook where you've got you know, inspirational ideas here, but then questions for self-reflection, and then some informal practices to take forward with you each day. It's set up in a 66-day cycle. That's accessible via my website. There's a couple other things that I have going on right now. One is that I'm going to be launching in the next couple of days, or sometime this week, a free 9-day email course on how to find peace over the over the holidays. So if you go to my website, on the main page, you'll see a link for where you can sign up for that. I also teach multi-week courses on compassion. It's a blend of what I learned through the Stanford program along with my own Taoist background. And I teach those at a couple of different communities in Washington State, but also I facilitate online, which is really nice. So you can be anywhere in the world and you can join in, and it's a multi-week course. We meet for 2 hours a day. And so I'm just about to launch my 2017 schedule. And then another really interesting opportunity is that I have started a program where every Monday through Friday, bright and early in the morning, especially for folks on the West Coast at 5:30 in the morning, you can dial in on the phone lines and we'll do a guided meditation together. So it's a great way to, if you've been thinking about wanting to develop a mindfulness practice or meditation practice, or if you're looking for ways to incorporate more compassion into your life, then it's a really wonderful opportunity to have that support and have that structure and accountability 5 days a week. And you can find out about that on my website as well. It's called Morning Meditation with Amy Colvin.
Oh, lovely. So many great ways for people to get in touch and get support. So thank you so much for your time and all the valuable information today. It's been a pleasure, Amy.
And thank you for having this conversation with me, Kiyomi. I really appreciate the opportunity.